This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll hear about a deal brokered with the government and the mercenary operation Blackwater Worldwide.
Among other things, Blackwater was illegally exporting weapons to Afghanistan, training troops in South Sudan, and in fact, organizing assassination teams.
For years, the U.S. government has forbidden U.S. travel to Cuba.
The year after the 1959 Cuban Revolution, when the travel ban was instigated, American journalist William Worthy traveled to Cuba and was arrested. Phil Oakes, the great political songwriter, wrote a song called The Battle of William Worthy. The verse that just sticks in my head, William Worthy is unworthy to enter our shore. He went down to Cuba. He's not American anymore. But somehow it is sad to hear the State Department say, you are living in the free world. In the free world, you must stay.
Stay with us. Michael, we have a disturbing development in the case of Lori Berenson.
Yeah, it's terrible. She was in prison for so long. She gave birth to a child. She finally got out. And the development was just terrible.
Basically, for listeners who may not know what happened, Lori Berenson, who's 40 years of age, was released 2 months ago from a prison in Peru where she'd been held on terrorism charges for nearly 15 years. She's now going back to prison to complete her 20-year sentence. So that means she has 5 years left for collaborating, allegedly, with the Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement, left-wing group that waged war in the government in the 80s and 90s. And so she'll be due now to be released in November 2015.
Yeah, and she's in prison with her baby.
That's right. She had a child with a lawyer who had represented her, I believe. I'm not sure if he still is. And Berenson apologized for her actions. She told the hearing board on August 16th she was sorry if anything she did caused harm to Peru. She acknowledged making a mistake coming to Peru back in 94. This is a setback. We thought we had a political prisoner. It was just joyous news when she was released a little over 2 months ago.
She was not part of the Tupac Amaru.
No.
Who I would say were fighting in self-defense. But in any case, she knew who they were. That was all. That was the connection. They victimized her. They made a right-wing political poster child out of her, put her away in this dark, dank prison where she literally got spinal disease, arthritic spine from it, 15 years, and she gets out and they put her back in on some kind of technical procedural question. We'll see whether or not they can keep her in.
And I should just clarify that Annabelle Apari, who is the father of her child, is in fact her current attorney.
You know, Heidi, the proposed Cordoba Islamic Cultural Center on Warren Street is right near my office, which is on Vesey Street, and it's right near my home in Battery Park City. So I've literally, you know, been there since before 9/11. I walk past the construction site at Ground Zero twice a day. When I walk north to get Indian food for lunch, I walk past Warren Street, which is four blocks, actually, not two, they say, but it's four blocks away from Ground Zero. And that's where they want to put this Cordoba Center in the old Burlington Coat Factory discount clothing store that's sitting there empty now. And they want to put the Cordoba Center in there. Well, the right wing has hit the streets on this. It was a predictable and really scary development. You know, in the past, the right wing had, you know, Fox News, which has helped me to organize this, and they had all these think tanks and newspapers and so on. But the missing element, people said, well, it's fascism. Well, it's not fascism. You know, fascism, we always understood, was when the right-wing people actually mobilize and they take into the streets. Well, last Sunday, we saw him in the streets with this racist, anti-Islamic rant against the Cordoba Center. And the ironies abound. You know, for one thing, Cordoba was one of the centers of human culture up until 1492, when Queen Isabella and her husband finally succeeded in driving out both the Muslims and the Jews from Spain and Portugal. I guess they call it the Cordoba Center because prior to Queen Isabella, the same queen, incidentally, who sent Christopher Columbus over here and began the genocide against the Indians. But in any case, Cordoba was this great capital trading center and center of knowledge and a place where Jews, Christians, and Muslims all coexisted. The person that's organizing this cultural center is an imam named Rauf, who's a very moderate man. He's a Sufi Islam. when he spoke at Daniel Pearl's funeral back in 2007, you know, the reporter for the Wall Street Journal that the Islamicists beheaded, Pearl's father was in the audience, and the Imam Rauf said, I am a Christian. And then he also said, I am a Jew. And he explained that he thought that the ethical message of all three religions was essentially the same. A very moderate man. But nonetheless, the right wing is using this to raise money and to get their troops in the streets, and it's really quite ugly. And what's so distressing is it's a total diversion. There are 20, 25 million people unemployed in this country, and these morons are talking about keeping a cultural center four blocks away from Ground Zero. It's a total diversion. It's a diversion from the real discussion. But you know, Heidi, we never had the real discussion after 9/11. Bush said they hate us for our freedoms and tried to direct people's anger first towards Afghanistan, where they started the first war, and then towards Iraq, where they lied and said that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction and they were part of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and they had to attack Iraq. That was a total lie. Well, this mosque business is also a total lie. And instead of coming to terms with why 9/11 happened, which isn't, it's not a mystery. People responsible for the crime said why they did it. They said, we did it for three reasons. For one thing, the U.S. Army's got these bases now in Saudi Arabia near our two holy cities, Mecca and Medina. And the second reason is they said the United States is crushing the Palestinians and supporting the Israelis. And the third is against the sanctions in Iraq. I remember when Leslie Stahl, the hostess of 60 Minutes, had Madeleine Albright, the Secretary of State, on as a guest, and Stahl said to Albright, well, the sanctions against Iraq have caused death by starvation of 600,000 children. What's your comment on that? Is it worth it? And Albright paused for a second, shook her head, and said, yes, it was worth it. Well, this goes around the world. People knew that. That discussion about blowback and why they destroyed those two buildings and killed almost 3,000 people was never had. The only person that tried to have that discussion, an intellectual named Susan Sontag, now deceased, was just crushed when she spoke out. And that discussion was never had, and it continues to be never had. So now you've got this total diversion on Warren Street. And you know, the irony is that there's been a mosque on Warren Street for the last 20 years. It's no threat to America. In fact, Frank Rich had a really good column in the Times last week where he said that these right-wingers are betraying General Petraeus because Petraeus is over there in Afghanistan trying to get the Muslims to make nice to the American soldiers. And all over the world media, you got this announcement that the United States has absolutely no tolerance for people of the Muslim faith. And you know, Heidi, there are 600,000 Muslims in New York City. From their own interests about keeping business as usual, you can understand where Bloomberg is coming from. And Bloomberg took a good position. You know, they don't want to alienate these people, and they don't want to alienate people worldwide. I mean, the main reason for Brown versus Board of Education decision in 1954 desegregating American schools was that the United States was looking like a racist country in the third world, particularly Africa. And that's in the decision in Brown versus Board. It was in the brief and it was in the decision. And now they're looking like the same kind of racist country with respect to the Islamic world. And that's so why the liberals have a different program how to advance the interests of imperialism from the conservatives. The conservatives seem like they just don't give a damn. They're kind of nihilistic in what they're willing to say. The liberals are a little more fine-tuned. It's in our interest to get the truth out about this.
Today we get an update from mountaintop removal activist Jimmy Tobias. Jimmy was arrested this summer with others for using direct action to shut down a coal mining mountaintop removal effort in West Virginia. He was held on a $3,500 bail and later released. A recent New York Times editorial states that movement to slow down and stop the mountaintop removal mining in that area is gaining traction, and the Obama administration is restricting permits for mountaintop removal mining. Jimmy Tobias, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
A couple of weeks ago, we interviewed some of your colleagues down there watching mountaintop removal, protesting, doing civil disobedience. What's been happening over the last couple of weeks?
Well, two of my fellow arrestees have had their court appearances, and they got off relatively lightly compared to some of our other members of the campaign. Sophie Kern got time served, and my friend Colin, who was my cellmate in jail for 10 days, got 6 months probation. And there's two of us left to go before the magistrate in September.
So you have to wait a few weeks. What are you hoping will happen?
He's hoping that you'll bake a cake with a file in it, Heidi.
Right, exactly. You know, they took plea deals. We're hoping for similar plea deals. And, you know, what will happen is if we get those plea deals, we'll probably kind of stay out of the game for a while, but then be able to resume our involvement. And so just kind of biding our time at this point.
And where are you actually right now?
I'm in West Virginia. I'm in Rock Creek, West Virginia, where the campaign houses are located.
Are you in this for the sort of short-term, long-term?
No, no. I'm going to be here on and off for the next 6 months, and then I'm hoping to come down for a year or more starting next spring.
Oh, that's fabulous. A real commitment.
The thing is, here at the campaign house, is like the campaign of civil disobedience has a big role, but there's a million other things people work on all the time.
Well, tell us what's going on down there between the bad guys and your people.
Okay, yeah. At the moment, we're gearing up for a mass mobilization in Washington that will take place between the 25th and the 27th of September. There'll be a day of action with civil disobedience, a few large strategy meetings between different like factions of the movement, some lobbying as well. And so that's kind of the next big important event, which will determine, I think, a lot of what happens in the future down here. At the moment, we're kind of focused on bringing national attention to the issue. I'm trying to solve it like at the federal level. And if that's not successful, I think there's going to be, I mean, hopefully it's successful, of course. And if it's not, there'll probably be some reflection and maybe a new direction. That's kind of the next thing. I should tell you that stay tuned to the website, to the Climate Ground Zero website, because there's going to be a surprise.
Okay, we will.
Jimmy Tobias, the New York Times had an opinion editorial a couple of days ago entitled A Mountain and a Stream, and they said that it's now possible to imagine the beginning of the end of a ruinous form of mining called mountaintop removal. He said that local opposition is building up and that the Environmental Protection Agency is getting involved. It was good to see it, and obviously that kind of thing, a result of what people like you are doing. What's your assessment of is this really the beginning and the end of it? The Bush administration let all this stuff happen, even though it's illegal. Is the Obama administration different? Is it possible to imagine the end of this? What's your take on it?
Well, I definitely agree with the statement that local opposition is growing. That is definitely true. And I think national opposition is growing as well. But I'm sort of loath to put my faith in the EPA to solve these problems. They've been really, their actions have been really ambiguous. They put forth like much more strict water quality guidelines that have serious implications and might really restrict new surface mines. But then I think only a few months ago they permitted a new massive mine in Logan County, but then they also are holding back another massive mine in Logan County. And so they just keep going back and forth, and it's really hard to get a sense of the ultimate outcome of their actions. And partly in it, that's what we're trying to do in September in D.C. is put pressure on them and push them in a certain direction. But it's hard to say from a federal level. I truly think that like the legislation has been passed before, and regulations have been devised before to deal with the problem of surface mining, and here we are today with this like catastrophe going on here. I think the real solution to the problem will be at the local level. If the local citizenry can get organized and can take on the coal companies, and especially the land companies and the railroad companies and the lumber companies that totally dominate this landscape, then I think there'll be a lasting solution. You know, my personal passion is for the local organizing and for the local movement that's being built, because I think that's really that will make or break it, basically.
Jimmy, about how many protest-minded people are down there right now?
Well, it really varies. At this moment, a lot of people are in D.C. organizing, so not as many people are here right now. But locals, it's really hard to say how many locals are in support. Someone told me recently that we never know how much support we have until harvest season, because then people just bring boatloads of food over here to support us. But then in terms of outsider organizers or younger people who have come down here at this camp, there are anywhere between 30 to 60 people at a given time. And we have, four campaign houses and big outdoor kitchen. Everyone eats together. organizes together. Everyone works on different aspects of the campaign. So here right now, I would say, yeah, about 25.
What's your website?
Well, there's a bunch of different projects. The Civil Disobedience Campaign is called Climate Ground Zero, and it was founded by Mike Rozelle, who was also a co-founder of Earth First and has a long history in the radical environmental movement. And so that's Climate Ground Zero. There's Coal River Mountain Watch, which is like the principal, one of two principal local organizations.
Say that again, please.
Coal River Mountain Watch.
Yes.
Yeah, it was on Coal River Mountain where I was arrested. That's kind of the line in the sand for a lot of local people. There's this new strip mine up there, so we're trying to stop that. And that organization, Coal River Mountain Watch, is kind of what started it all. They're like the locals' resistance organization. They do a lot of community organizing. There's Sludge Safety Project, which is focused on water quality issues, water protection, and the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, which is a statewide environmental organization. And then there's Mountain Justice, which is a regional network of youth, mostly, who are fighting mountaintop removal.
Jimmy, what's your opinion on the administration is looking to review an existing permit that would give the Spruce Mine in Blair, West Virginia, 2,278 acres. What do you think is going to happen? I mean, they've already poisoned or covered over 2,000 miles of streams, and now they're looking at another 2,200 acres to defile. What's your opinion as to whether or not the EPA is going to let them do that?
That's a really hard question. It could really go in either direction. But what I can tell you is that that Spruce Mine number one is next to Hobet Mine, which is one of the biggest MTR sites down here, and it's just a total catastrophe when you go up there. It's just the whole place is just completely destroyed. Everything is just this gray, dusty, useless, crater-like swath of land, and it's really horrific. And if they do continue, I mean, they'll just be continuing the destruction that's already taken place, and it would be a tragedy, of course. It really depends. I think if we can make a strong statement in D.C. in September, it'll help prevent that permit from going through. That's one of the foremost issues on our minds right now, that permit. It would be a catastrophe if it happened.
Well, Jimmy Tobias, thank you very much for being our guest on Law and Disorder. To repeat, there are demonstrations and actions in Washington, D.C. From September 25th to the 27th. You can get the website, and we'll post this also, Jimmy, Climate Ground Zero and Coal River Mountain Watch. Both of those, we wish you every success. We look forward to your being back on Law and Disorder.
Thanks.
Thanks, Jimmy. Thank you. Keep up the good work.
Thanks a lot.
Private security company, formerly called Blackwater Worldwide, has reached an agreement with the U.S. State Department for hundreds of violations of U.S. export control regulations. The company, now called the U.S. Training Center, will pay the government $42 million in fines to avoid criminal charges on export violations. The violations include shipping weapons to Iraq hidden inside containers of dog food. There are other legal troubles facing Blackwater officials, but the company continues to obtain government contracts. Last June, Blackwater was awarded a $120 million contract to provide security at a State Department regional office in Afghanistan, and the CIA renewed the firm's $100 million security contract in Kabul. Today we get an update from investigative journalist and author Jeremy Scahill. Jeremy is the author of the international bestseller called Blackwater: The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. Jeremy, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Good to be back with you.
We followed Blackwater for a while, and now we have a settlement where Blackwater has to pay $42 million in fines for literally hundreds of violations of U.S. export control regulations. What do you think about this?
This is a company that has been repeatedly involved with criminal activity, with murder, has basically gotten off scot-free time and time again because it's been shielded by its handlers at the State Department or at the Department of Defense. And the idea that this criminal corporation can pay, what amounts to $146,000 per violation is just outrageous. And, you know, while there are a number of very important revelations in this State Department settlement about Blackwater's involvement, you know, with illicit arms deals, with fraud and other actions, the real meat of it is the murder that they've been involved with, the human rights violations, and that's not reflected here at all. And the fact is that the Obama administration continues to contract with this company. Just in the past month, the administration has issued them $250 million in new contracts for the CIA and the State Department. And I think a lot of people that have followed this for a long time are left asking, you know, what would it take for this company to be knocked completely off the U.S. government payroll?
What concerns me, I think, is that this company was kind of going into business on its own. And I think that the State Department saw this as a bit of a fight within the family, not even a fight, a tiff. But I think the State Department didn't want them kind of overstepping their bounds and forming their own independent foreign policy separate from, you know, that of the government as a whole. Is that your take on it?
I think what is clear here is that there's two things that I think people need to realize. One is that U.S. operations, particularly in Afghanistan right now, have become so dependent upon Blackwater, both for the CIA and the State Department, that the Obama administration has made a judgment that they literally cannot keep their war going in Afghanistan without these guys. But the second, and I think more important point, is that Eric Prince, the owner of Blackwater, who has since fled to the United Arab Emirates, he's now living in Abu Dhabi, which has no extradition treaty with the United States. Interesting that he moves there after his five top deputies get indicted on conspiracy charges and weapons charges in the United States. He runs away to Abu Dhabi. This is a company, though, and this is a man, who know literally where the bodies are buried. They were working special access programs for the Central Intelligence Agency, for the Joint Special Operations Command, the elite U.S. military unit that is portrayed as the premier counterterrorism unit around the world. They know the kind of dirty actions that they were involved with. And so what you essentially see is what's called gray mail, where Eric Prince and Blackwater are sort of daring the government to come after them in any substantive way, because the tale that they could tell in an open courtroom would be devastating to U.S. operations around the world that have the intent of furthering this sort of state of permanent war. In other words, they could reveal details of actions that would horrify the average American if they knew that these things were being done in their name through private companies. So I agree that the State Department, on the one hand, Michael, is trying to, you know, keep them under their wing, so to speak. But on the other hand, it's also, I think, a very dangerous chess game, because Blackwater has been involved with so many clandestine operations and could really blow the lid off of this. I mean, this could be stuff that's on par with Iran-Contra or other major scandals involving U.S. military or intelligence agencies, and it has sort of flashes of Iran-Contra because of the involvement of these kind of off-the-books operators like Blackwater has been for the CIA and the U.S. military.
What, though, Jeremy? What kind of stuff do you suspect that they did that would be so horrific if it got out?
There's certain things that we know and that I know in particular from having talked to Blackwater people, CIA people, and others. What happened after 9/11 is that Eric Prince, the owner of Blackwater, cut a deal with the number three man at the CIA, a guy named Alvin Buzzy Krongard. Krongard at the CIA and Prince at Blackwater essentially agreed to train an assassination squad on one of Eric Prince's properties in the state of Virginia. And they trained a squad that would specialize in what are called F-cubed operations, the letter F, F-cubed, find, fix, and finish. They were going to deploy around the world to hunt people that were identified, sometimes on the flimsiest of information or intelligence, that were identified as threats to the United States, and they were going to track them, figure out a way where these individuals were vulnerable, and then take them out. We know of several specific cases where Blackwater went into countries with these secretive teams, and they went in dark, meaning that the CIA station chief in those countries, U.S. ambassador, were not even aware of their presence. And in one particular case, Eric Prince had a team that went into Germany, which, of course, is a major U.S. ally, and their job was to hunt down a German citizen and to kill that individual. And the operation, when CIA officials found out about it, they called off the killing of this person at the very last moment. But the fact was that you had a private company that was being used essentially off the books, off the radar of even senior officials at the CIA, certainly off the radar of people within the military chain of command, operating inside the borders of a U.S. ally without informing that country, without informing the CIA station chief. And in some cases, Michael, Blackwater's owner, Eric Prince, was personally bankrolling the operations so that there would literally be no paper trail for the Congress to discover and explore further. There are also, I've heard, cases of Blackwater working on operations inside of Syria, where the United States has no declared war, and participating in military-style operations. To sort of put a fine point on why this is outrageous, these are actions that were taken explicitly to keep Congress and the American people in the dark about operations that put in front of a court of law would be determined to be illegal and unconstitutional.
Jeremy, I know that at least two former Blackwater guards are facing murder charges stemming from the killing of two Afghans last year. Is there any chance that any of the information you just mentioned could come out at a trial from them?
There's almost no chance that that would happen. I mean, what we've seen over the let's say 10 years or so that Blackwater has been facing some form of litigation or another is that the courts in this country, be it judges or prosecutors, have really deferred to Blackwater's handlers from the CIA or the military in terms of keeping certain things away from court proceedings, not just in the form of sealing documents, but in the form of saying we're not going to even entertain those that line of questioning or investigation in these cases. They try to really narrow the focus down to the lowest people on the pole. As we saw at Abu Ghraib, when Lindy England and Charles Grainer, the soldiers, go down for this, no one in the chain of command does. So, you know, you raised this case of the guys who allegedly murdered these Afghan civilians. I believe these guys should be prosecuted. I've followed that case very closely. But at the end of the day, Blackwater is the employer sets the tone for the kinds of actions that took place, and that's at the center of that complaint. The one case that could potentially raise these issues in a court is a case that's gotten almost no media attention, and that is that there are two former Blackwater employees, a man and a woman. The man was a Blackwater shooter, an operator who worked in war zones. The woman worked on the financial side. They have filed a whistleblower case against Blackwater. They are alleging extrajudicial killings of civilians, as well as bilking U.S. taxpayers, putting strippers on the U.S. government payroll in New Orleans, and classifying, when Blackwater was working for FEMA down there, classifying them as cleaning women, having prostitutes on the payroll in Afghanistan that were described as sort of recreational devices, the idea of arms smuggling. That's the case where these things really could come up. And the judge in that case ordered a deposition to be taken from Eric Prince by the lawyer, Susan Burke, in that case, who's worked with the Center for Constitutional Rights on Blackwater cases. And she actually went over to Abu Dhabi on August 23rd and deposed Eric Prince for 7 hours in that case and got into some of this. Now, whether we're going to see it appear in an open court anywhere is another question, but I know that Susan Burke knows this story inside and out, and I guarantee you she asks these kinds of questions. Whether they'll ever see the light of day, that's another issue, as you both know, being lawyers.
I wanted you to comment on this. The CIA and the State Department have hired Blackwater. They gave him $120 million in June for security in Afghanistan, and they asked Leon Panetta, the head of the CIA, what about this $120 million here? CIA gave you $100 million a few weeks later, and Leon Panetta said he defended it, and he said Blackwater has cleaned up his act. What's your take on that?
Right. Well, they've cleaned up their act about as much as BP has cleaned up the Gulf. Blackwater is engaged in ongoing extrajudicial activity around the world. And, you know, Leon Panetta is either so out of the loop that he's not aware of it, or he's running cover for a criminal enterprise because somebody somewhere within his operations is saying, we can't cut the Blackwater guys loose. I mean, let's remember, when we talk about Leon Panetta and the CIA, let's remember that Blackwater was involved with secret assassination programs in countries around the world where we aren't at war, where they weren't informing those countries. They were deeply involved with the CIA drone bombing campaign in Pakistan and Afghanistan. Blackwater has run its own counter-narcotics operations in Afghanistan, where it's called in airstrikes. This is a company that is flush with men who are veterans of the most elite U.S. military forces at a time when U.S. forces are stretched thin. So, you know, for Leon Panetta to co-sign some kind of rebranding of Blackwater, I think is a really devastating commentary on how little things have changed from Bush to Obama when it comes to the issue of relying so heavily on these kinds of criminal corporations that have engaged in extrajudicial activities around the world on the U.S. taxpayer dime.
We should note that actually Blackwater has changed its new name is XC Services.
Yeah, I refuse to call them by anything other than Blackwater because I think it's,
right.
it's part of their game. But it's actually,
yes,
it's pronounced Z.
Z.
You know, the XC, and you know, it's from the gas, which has no properties and can't be detected, and that's sort of the reason that they chose that name. No, they and actually, Heidi, in a way, you're so last year because they actually are getting contracts now under a different name. The U.S. Training Center, which makes it sound like, you know, some kind of a Olympic ice skating training facility or something. But, you know, the unfortunate reality is they're going to be around for a long time, I fear. And really the only serious challenges to them have been from those evil trial lawyers, people like Michael Ratner and Susan Burke and, you know, and others that have had the audacity to stand up against this company because Congress certainly isn't doing anything. Representative Jan Schakowsky, who's on the Intelligence Committee, introduced a bill a few months ago called the Stop Outsourcing Security Act that's aimed at shutting these guys down and getting them off the U.S. government payroll, and there's only 25 co-sponsors to that bill. There's only one sponsor of it in the Senate, Senator Bernie Sanders. You know, where are the Democrats on this issue? It shows the spinelessness of Democrats, in particular in the Congress and in the White House, because war is business. Business is good, and war companies give a lot of money to the campaign coffers of Democrats and Republicans alike. And so, you know, no one wants to take on the war business because they fear that it'll mean they don't get that cash cow anymore.
As usual with Blackwater, just shocking and distressing. But thanks for filling us in on this.
My pleasure, and thank you for what you guys are doing.
Yeah, thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Revolution happened in 1959. The ban preventing Americans from going to Cuba was installed a year afterwards and has been in effect more or less ever since. Will the Obama administration change this ban? Obama could do it with a stroke of the pen because the ban makes it illegal not travel to Cuba but spending money in Cuba. It's a Treasury Department violation. Obama could change that quite simply. Will he do it? Will the right of the American people to travel freely around the world be restored? We talk with Sandy Levinson, the head of the Center for Cuban Studies, who's been to Cuba 300 times, about what the chances are and what you'll see if you get to Cuba.
Sandy Levinson, welcome to Law & Disorder.
Thank you very much.
Well, here on Law & Disorder, we're ever hopeful that the travel ban to Cuba will be lifted, and you have had perhaps more experience in arranging trips to travel than most of our guests. Tell us briefly about your history with going to Cuba and organizing visits.
Well, of course, the center started in 1972, and as early as 1973, we started doing trips. Of course, the only legal trips at that time were those that involved an invitation from the Cuban government, because since the travel regs are not really travel regs, they are regulations set up by the Treasury Department at the instigation of the State Department.
You can go to Cuba, you just can't spend money there.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
You cannot spend money. And so the idea behind the invitations was that if you were a guest of the Cuban government, you were not going to spend any money in Cuba. So our very first trip was a lawyer's trip, actually. We thought that was a good idea.
And you've seen the changes in the laws over the past couple of decades now with the Bush administration, perhaps the harshest that we've ever seen.
Well, they've been harsh all along and not really the harshest in the sense that, after all, under the Bush administration, there were categories under which you could travel to Cuba and spend money. And so when we started, they were the harshest because you couldn't travel at all unless you were an invited guest. That changed with Carter because when Carter was president, he lifted the travel ban and there were actually direct commercial flights from the United States to Cuba for the brief period of time that Carter was president. And then, of course, when Reagan came in, he immediately stopped all of that. We, for example, during the Carter administration, had actually set up a Spanish language school in Cuba, and we subsequently sued and went to the Supreme Court over the travel ban. And, of course, we lost 5-4. I mean, that's what always happens because of our Spanish language school. I mean, but Reagan stopped all of that. And we have always tried to do whatever trips were legal. As a 501c3, we try to do that and give advice to those people who wanted to travel illegally. But then with the Clinton administration, new kind of politics. Let's let a lot of people go to Cuba on educational trips, and the Cubans will see how much happier and more successful are people from the United States, and they will rise up and overthrow Fidel Castro. That was the hope. And so for the years of the Clinton administration, we were able to take a number of trips, whereas before, if you wanted to go down on an art trip, you had to be an art professional, or if you wanted to go on a legal trip, you had to be a lawyer. During the Clinton administration, you could go on any kind of trip that had been authorized by the Treasury Department. In other words, we had to send in an itinerary for every trip. If the itinerary was approved, anyone could go. So we did art and architecture trips, and anyone who liked art and architecture could go. You didn't have to be an architect, okay? And then with Bush, of course, all of that stopped and went back to pre-Clinton.
Sandy, the Cuban Revolution was in 1959, and the ban on traveling there, however severe or not severe over the years, has been in effect for 50 years. My question is, why do they ban trips to Cuba? Is it for the purpose of overthrowing the Cuban government or not allowing American people to learn what's going on? What's going on with this? Why is this policy in effect?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. You know, number one, the rationale has always been we don't want to give money to Castro, right? And the idea was that if there were too many U.S. citizens traveling to Cuba, that would, in effect, give money to Castro. And so that was fueled by the right-wing exile community out of Miami, Union City, wherever they happen to be, with a lot of political clout. Florida is a very important state. And the travel ban, even though it affected the Cuban families as well, many of them supported it. Over the years, they have come not to support it. And now the majority of Cubans, even living in Miami, support an end to the travel ban, not necessarily an end to the embargo. The other interesting thing is to see who over the years has been in support of ending the travel ban. For example, it always amused me that William F. Buckley Jr. was in support of ending the travel ban because he and conservatives like him truly believed their own rhetoric, which was that the only thing keeping Fidel Castro in power was our embargo and the travel ban, and that in fact, if we ended the travel ban and Cuba was over, was filled with U.S. tourists, that the Cubans would very quickly see the light. But, you know, they've never believed their own propaganda. They haven't called the bluff, which they should.
Cuba is the largest island in the Caribbean. I think it's as big as all the other islands combined. And it has hundreds and hundreds of miles of beautiful beaches and extraordinary architecture in Havana. Havana was like one of the main cities in the world 400 years ago. It's really a shame that more Americans don't have a chance to to go down to Cuba. But to a certain extent, you've alleviated that
problem.
You
can go with us.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because I know the Center for Cuban Studies is organizing trips down there in the fall and the winter. Give us some highlights on that.
Well, we've got a lot of trips going now because, first of all, the center finally was able to get a humanitarian license for a really interesting project that we have in Cuba. It's a project that is very much in tune with our interest in art and with the fact that we opened a gallery and the fact that we sued the U.S. government to make it legal to bring in Cuban art. And we won, by the way. But because of that, we started this project to help young adults with Down syndrome do artwork. And so it took us 10 months before we were given the license from Treasury. Other people get humanitarian licenses in a month or two. All they have to say is that they're helping the dissidents, and that's their humanitarian project. But ours is a real project. We work with artists who are working with kids with Down syndrome, and they're wonderful. We have a project in Pinar del Rio. We have one in Havana where we work with Caritas. We have one in Cienfuegos where this wonderful Father Jairo, who is a Colombian priest, is in charge of the project. And we take people down to visit the projects and bring art materials and interact with the kids. And so we can take, you know, we have several trips that are humanitarian trips. Then we have trips that are of educators. We like to take down especially high school teachers and academics because for every person you take down, it expands the knowledge of Cuba because of their classroom activities. And so we do as many as we can.
And in addition to the humanitarian and the educator trips, what other ones are you taking down?
Well, we can always do professional trips. Right. For example, I'm leading a trip for professional artists. It's a folk art seminar in Cuba and is at the same time as an international folk art fair in Havana. And so what we're going to do is go to the fair, but even more important, we're going to travel to all kinds of little communities outside of Havana to visit folk artists wherever they are. For example, we found a lovely 24-year-old woman who makes dolls, and beautiful dolls, and all by hand. When I first saw them, I thought it must be a little old lady up in the hills somewhere making them. No, she lives in the hills, but she's a young woman, a hippie.
So to get back to going to Cuba, if Heidi wanted to go or I wanted to go or our producer Jeff Brady wanted to go, they just couldn't go.
Not if they wanted to go legally. I mean, you could because you're a lawyer. You can go down and do professional research in the law.
So who would I have to get permission from?
You don't have to get permission. You go under – I did this a couple of years ago. I just went. I had a typed itinerary to meet with legal professionals to research the Cuban Five. And then when you come through customs, they had someone from Homeland Security interrogate me. And I just kept – he said, where's your license? I kept saying, I don't need one. I'm under the general license,
right,
which says that legal professionals can go
– Any professional.
Any professional to pursue research. They say that they'd like you to have the goal of publicizing or
– Obviously, you're doing it because you're on the radio.
Right.
Well, Sandy,
right.
You know, Michael Ratner and I are working on a book on the assassination of Che Guevara and how the CIA was behind it. Could we just go there? We want to publicize the book once it's published, or do we have to get permission from somebody? Or
well,
how would that work?
You're both lawyers, and you fall under, as Heidi said, the general license. The general license is not something you apply for. It's by assertion, and you simply say that as legal professionals, you're doing legal research. It doesn't matter what the subject is. That is not something that the U.S. government has to interrogate you on. As long as you are doing research, which is legitimately legal research, which this would be.
Is there much travel to Cuba by Americans who don't happen to be lawyers, who just want to go there and check things out for themselves?
Of course. I think tens of thousands of people go, in quotes, illegally. They go through Canada or Jamaica or the Dominican Republic or Mexico. And it's been made very clear, I think, by the Obama administration that they are not pursuing illegal travelers. So the fact is that, you know, under Bush, they pursued the illegal travelers. Now it seems that a person who just wants to go to Cuba for whatever reason doesn't have much of a problem.
Except that they shouldn't lie when they come back.
They should not lie.
That's
right.
They should say Cuba.
That's right. And I think they should say it loud and proud.
And if somebody wants to go down with you, Sandy Levinson, and the Center for Cuban Studies, how do they contact you? What's your website?
TravelToCubaNow@gmail.com, direct email, TravelToCubaNow@gmail.com. Our telephone is 212-242-0559. We've been there so much. We know so many people that we don't, our travel is not formal. It's intimate. We go into people's homes. We visit artists in their studios, in their homes. I always take people to my friends. I mean, I think that this is as important as seeing the official Cuba, is seeing how people live every day and have them with you.
That's lovely.
And getting back to the law, though, is there any chance that this Treasury Department law that says you can't go to Cuba because you can go there, but you can't spend money there, so therefore you can't go there legally. Is there any chance of getting this thing changed? And what forces in the United States are behind getting this lousy law changed?
It's very hard to know why it hasn't been changed already. When Obama came into office, he should have done it with a stroke of the pen, frankly. There is no reason why he couldn't have done that immediately to go back to the Clinton administration rules. It's very amusing to me that everybody talks about the possibility that the Obama administration is going to make a huge stride forward by changing the rules of the travel ban. All they've been talking about is going back to what Clinton did. So a huge stride forward, which is backward. I think that the forces in favor of it are many. Everybody who wants to travel, and that's almost everybody in the United States. But what has always stopped it and what is stopping it now is, for example, Senator Menendez of New Jersey says he will do anything he has to stop this. He doesn't want dollars to go to the Castro brothers. I mean, this is such an old argument. It looks so dated at this time in history. I think that one of the things that amused me was when the Bush administration came into power, he also ended the possibility of going down as an invited guest. And when we called the Treasury Department to ask why, how could you do that? You're not going to spend money. They said, well, because Cuba is an island, everyone has to arrive by a carrier. And whatever carrier you arrive on, be it a boat or plane, whatever, they have to pay landing fees. And those landing fees are distributed among all of the passengers. And therefore, you're giving Cuba money.
So I'm taking a kayak.
Right.
It's really a stretch.
It's a stretch, yes.
Sandy, what's your perception about how the Cubans that you come into contact with, I know you have friends, but generally the others, what are their perceptions about Americans?
Well, I think that U.S. citizens have always been, who travel to Cuba, have always been looked upon as friends because they know what the regulations and the laws are, and therefore they incorrectly, I think, assume that everyone from the United States who does come to Cuba must be a friend. That doesn't mean that they think that they support the Cuban Revolution. They know, in fact, that most U.S. citizens do not support the Cuban Revolution. But they do know that people who travel there support some kind of friendship, at least with the people, and that they're not afraid to spend money because the Castro brothers will get it. I think most people who travel from the United States assume that whatever money they're spending is going to help an economy that's in dire trouble and will see it as something that they want to do. I don't know what will happen when the travel ban is lifted. I think we all have fears about the McDonald's being put in to satisfy the U.S. tourists and things like that. But there is no doubt about it. Cuba needs an infusion from the United States, not just of tourists. But although the food and medicine embargo was lifted several years ago, the regulations about payment are so tough on the Cubans. Everyone else can buy on credit. The Cubans cannot. They have to pay up front before a ship leaves United States territory with the food or with the medicine. The money has to be in their hands and proved to the U.S. Treasury Department and the State Department that they have the money.
Sandy, how did you first get interested in things Cuban?
I went there.
When?
1969, yeah. I was working for Ramparts Magazine. You remember it, Michael?
I used to subscribe.
So he's got a copy of Ramparts here for those of you in the radio audience who cannot see it. Yes, I was the New York editor of Ramparts Magazine, and I was teaching politics at Brooklyn Poly at that time. I fell in love with Cuba. You know, my first trip was 6 weeks. I arrived on July 4th, 1969, with a lot of other people from the United States. I was there for 6 weeks. And, you know, I really felt that I had been lied to by the establishment press and by my government, because Cuba was nothing as I imagined. As I was going over on the plane from Mexico, I had to admit to myself, well, Sandra, you'll probably really admire the Cuban Revolution because you think you're a socialist, but you probably wouldn't want to live there. Because I, too, had grown up in this country, and what's more, I grew up in the Midwest. So anything communist was gray and boring, and everybody talked alike, thought alike, walked alike. And that's, you know, down deep inside me, I thought that Cuba would be a little bit like whatever picture I had or didn't have of the Soviet Union. And, of course, bang, socialism with salsa. It was not at all what I expected.
Did you have a chance to meet Fidel Castro?
Yes.
What was that like? What do you think of him?
On the fifth day of my first trip, he taught me to cut sugarcane.
Wow.
So what did I think of him? He was a very good teacher.
What do you think of him now?
Well, I think he's probably one of the smartest leaders we've ever had in this hemisphere. I think he's been incredibly intelligent about the way he's handled the relation with the United States. I don't think he's had a chance to show how smart he is. I remember once a dinner with a group of people I'd brought down, including Jack Lemmon and his wife and his son and his daughter. And we were having dinner together with Gabriel Garcia Marquez, a very distinguished group of people, right? At one point, Fidel got up to look for the dessert. And while he was gone, Jack Lemmon poked his son, Chris, because he said, Chris, what's the matter with you? You look so depressed. This is a wonderful evening. And Chris Lemmon said, Dad, I just can't stand it. This guy deserves a bigger country. He's the president of Cuba, and look what we've got in Washington. This was during the Reagan administration. And I think, you know, I think that's probably true. Fidel probably deserved a bigger country. Cuba was too small for him. But I think that, you know, Fidel Castro's history will be written by future historians. To me, he's been an incredible teacher, not just a teacher of sugarcane cutting, but of someone who stuck by his principles despite the fact that it was very, very, very difficult, and it would have been very easy to sell out along the way. We all know that at a certain point people say, hey, listen, you know, he stuck too close to his principles because Cuba's in deep trouble and he should have given in a little, and maybe Raul is giving in a little. But I think that it's tough to know who would know what we would think of Simon Bolivar if he had been in power for almost 50 years. We just don't know. I mean, there are great people in history who never had a chance to be in power as long as Fidel Castro. I think that he's been in power that long because we have not had relations with Cuba. And I think that our embargo, our blockade, our hatred of everything of the Cuban Revolution has really helped to, if not destroy civil society in Cuba, make it very, very difficult for civil society to survive in the way that the Cubans have wanted it to.
I totally agree with you. I think that was the intent of the embargo and the economic and diplomatic and political hostility since 1959, before 1959.
Yes.
I think that was the same policy the United States, say, had to overthrow the Russian Revolution. It took them from 1917 to 1991 to do it, but they did it. And they haven't yet overthrown the Cuban Revolution. And I think the great accomplishment of Fidel is to keep it on its legs, however wobbly, hoping that its example will spread, and it still might.
You know, an example of a person who is principled.
Sure.
Yes.
You know, there aren't very many principled leaders in any government in the world these days, even if you don't like the principles, you know. I always thought that, you know, the Democrats in this country never learned the lesson of Ronald Reagan, which was that most people in the country disagreed with his policies, but most people liked him because he stuck to his principles.
I didn't agree with his policies, nor like him. Sandy Levinson, you have any last thoughts on the Cuban travel ban before we let you go?
Just, I know you may think that your representative and your senator already will vote the right way, but they have to feel it. They have to feel your passion. They have to know that you as constituents care about lifting the travel ban, not that it's just, oh, something, let's vote for it. You know, we don't want any hassle. No, they have to fight for it. So please, everybody, write to people in Washington, take a stand, and travel to Cuba. I mean, that's the best way to take a stand, is to travel there.
Spoken like a true Cuban. Thank you, Sandy. It's been a joy to have you here.
Thank you, Sandy.
Thank you very much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Well, it's of a bold reporter, a story I will tell. He went down to the Cuban land, the nearest place to hell. He'd been there many times before, but now the law does say the only way to Cuba is with the CIA. William Worthy isn't worthy to enter our door. Went down to Cuba, he's not American.